Yeah, so here's the story quickly, since we, before we turned the microphones on, we were talking about religion, folks, and we're not going to talk about it much more. But this morning, I went down to Sam Church and the Friendship House because we heard through our well-placed sources that the police ticketed a group that had a tent on A Street between Shipley and Orange, and that ticket basically set the clock at 24 hours, and they were going to come sweep out. With my count, it was about 6 people and 2 dogs, I think, or maybe 5 people and 2 dogs. I was trying to get a count. So they were going to sweep that this morning, but we got a group out there to sort of, like, I don't know, document what they were doing and make them feel bad about it. You can go to both my feed on X the Everything app and Blue Sky, both. I'm going both now, but you can go on there and take a look at it. But I will say that, to your point, Sam Church is really a leader in sort of, like, doing the things that need to be done. We'll just put it that way. So, yeah, so shout out to Father Patrick Burke. He'll be on here soon because we're going to do, like, a series on this sort of homeless sweeps they've been doing. I can say that Spotlight Delaware not only covered the original issue when they cut those benches out, but I also, we spied Kay Baker today lurking around. And Brianna, who wrote the original story, was talking to our friend Cheyenne Miller for some reason. Who knows why? So there's going to be some coverage. People are not going to let sort of, like, these tactics stand. I took a very funny video standing at the corner showing the BPG building, the press that's going up over here, and just turning 180 degrees and showing what was happening on basically right behind me. So it's not complicated. If anybody wants to know, like, if anybody's confused or, like, doesn't know why it's happening, I have a 30-second video online that explains everything, and then you're done. This is what college professors wish they could do. In 30 seconds, I could teach the whole lesson, and you're fucking done. You all understand everything.
That second part is tough. You could say 30 seconds. Do people walk away with understanding? But I appreciate it. Video makes a difference. That's true.
We are in the shadow of Rockford Tower. At least I am. Dale is probably deeper in the Delaware Way Beast, deeper in the belly of the Delaware Way Beast than any of us, in a sort of a different way.
Being digested.
Yeah. But we wanted to do a fun sort of episode for everybody on Thanksgiving. So you'll be listening to this, if you're listening to it on the day it comes out, on Black Friday, Thanksgiving Friday. And there's always been sort of a conversation I've wanted to have, and I think now's the time to have it. So I appreciate our friend, the historian Dale Norwood, coming on to discuss it with me, because he has all the – he's gonna make sure that I don't – he knows all the specifics. You know, I kind of I'm gonna vibe, and then he's gonna tell you, like, okay, you know, this was true, that's not really true, and all that stuff. So
I'm here for corrections. Is it okay?
Yeah, like context. You're like, well, that you kind of were exaggerating a little bit there, I think.
Context, I could do context. I feel more comfortable with, yeah, the wider fabric. Yeah,
so I was able to talk to my neighbor before I came up here to record this. And she asked me what I was doing, and I said, we're doing this Thanksgiving special. But before I told her exactly what we're going to talk about, I gave her a little, like, Rob Vanilla 5-minute speech. So I want to give the same speech to you, but I want you to sort of be like, where I'm exaggerating, because I have a tendency to do that, or where I'm sort of like, I'm like, oh, this, and you're like, well, not really. So I'm going to give you my little setup, and then you sort of tell me where I'm at. So Thanksgiving was a regional sort of harvest celebration. There were no hard and fast rules about how you did it. There was myths all around it that probably Dale knows, being from Massachusetts. He was deep in the belly of Thanksgiving myths.
Pilgrim territory, yeah. Nothing but buckles on our hats, onions
exactly.
on our belts.
Exactly. But not until 1863 did Lincoln say that the country should celebrate this Thanksgiving festival, this autumn festival, on the fourth Thursday of November, and that will be a national holiday. Now, in 1863, it was probably not the greatest time to do this because a lot of people were not interested in doing this. And we don't. I think it's pretty obvious what that is. And actually, when the Civil War ended, we got a drunken tailor from Tennessee who was not really interested in doing the things that we won for. Now we'll just leave. We'll leave Andrew Johnson to the side. After him, we'll point people to the Richard White episode that we did on Reconstruction in the Gilded Age. We cover that goddamn nasty drunk, you know, we get him good. In 1869, 4 years after the Civil War ends, finally, the radical Republicans are in the ascendancy, and U.S. Grant is elected president. The hero of Appomattox is the president. So now it looks like, you know, things could work out. We could get the revolution that we always talk about. And one of the things was to start to really push this national Thanksgiving holiday. And the famous cartoonist for Harper's Weekly, Thomas Nast, creates a cartoon called Uncle Sam's Thanksgiving Dinner. And I've always sent it out on Thanksgivings. I've always thought it was a really interesting piece of sort of Americana in a time of history that I'm really super interested in. But the first thing I want to do is, Dale, can you sort of give us the background, a little bit about Nast, and just like describe the what you're looking at in the cartoon?
Sure. So, I don't have much to disagree with your narrative there. Though I would say that even Lincoln's embrace of this holiday in 63 is he's taking over. He's been persuaded by this campaign by a woman by the name of Sarah Josepha Buell Hale, who is a New Hampshire writer and editor in Goody's Ladies Book, which is a big middle class women's magazine, really the only one of the time. And she was explicitly promoting Thanksgiving on the New England tradition, this kind of invented tradition of the pilgrims and all that stuff, as a harvest festival that is religious but not tied to a specific Christian holiday, promoting it as a day of national unity, right? And that builds on kind of earlier traditions of many different, you know, leaders at many different times asking for days of fasting or days of Thanksgiving. That's a pretty common feature in the North and the South in the colonial period and the early national. So Lincoln is in part doing what presidents have long done and asking the nation to say thanks, but also to pray. But he's specifically that, you know, November moment is Hale has written a lot of stories, written a lot of short stories that kind of romanticize it and create this domestic picture of Thanksgiving. And she's part of a whole coterie of New England anti-slavery abolitionist women writers that are on this kind of thing, that, you know, songs like, you know, a lot of our children's songs and things like that, and come from these folks. So anyway, but this Thomas Nast cartoon, Thomas Nast is a German, a Bavarian immigrant, who grows up, he emigrates when he's six with his family. His father had been a trombonist in the Bavarian army, and then comes into some hot water, joins various European navies. And he's, it seems to me, I would love to know a little bit more about this, but his father doesn't have a biography about him, but his father seems to be a guy who gets into hot water, maybe for his politics, maybe just because he was tired of hanging around people. He emigrates to America and sends his family, and they grow up in New York. So Thomas Nast is a German immigrant growing up in New York City. And in his in the late 1850s, he, you know, starts to get noticed for his artwork, his drawing work. And this is the time of the great illustrated newspaper. So he starts drawing illustrations for they get printed and mass produced in Frank Leslie's Illustrated News, which is a kind of middle class periodical. And then he starts working for Harper's. And so by 1869, he's been working for Harper's for quite some time as, you know, drawing pictures for the news, but also offering editorial commentary. And he is a deep and profound supporter of the Republican Party and its more radical wing and of U.S. Grant in specific. And he draws this cartoon, Uncle Sam's Thanksgiving Dinner, in part to support the passage and ratification of the 15th Amendment, which gets passed the following year, and then also just the Grant presidency and the ideology that it surrounds it, which was this idea of America not as a melting pot — that's a later idea — but this idea of America as a place where people of color, African Americans, Native Americans, immigrants from China, from Germany, from Mexico, from all different parts of the world could come together. And the centerpiece of this cartoon, it's a big dining room table. So at the center of this table is a kind of sack looking centerpiece. It's kind of a little mini mountain with a little Roman or Greco-Roman little temple at the top. And on the bottom of it says universal suffrage. That is to say, everyone gets the vote. In this case, all men get the vote. And then self-government. So the core ideals of the United States as remade by the Republican Party, right, as a multiracial democracy, which is new. But this ending slavery with the 13th Amendment, extending civil rights with the 14th Amendment, and then expanding the right to vote to all natural and naturalized citizens with the 15th Amendment. This is building a society around this idea that everyone has got a stake, everyone can participate, and that's the genius of America, is self-government, rather than tyranny under the heels of a master or under the heels of the rich or under the heels of some petty tyrant, right? And around this table, there are people of all different kinds of ethnicities, and it's men and women. It's couples and pairs, in somewhat kind of wearing their native dress if they're immigrants. So you see people right in the foreground are a man and a woman dressed in Chinese clothing and the man has a long queue or hair, you know, ponytail kind of, or tail. And between them is a little baby in a high chair with the same kind of hairstyle. Next to them are some folks with kind of Eastern European garb. There's some African-American folks a little bit down the table. So all around this table, there are just people sitting together who are the people of the United States. And they're all tucking in and they're all getting along with each other. And it's men and women and children, and they're all enjoying this meal. And at the head of the table is Uncle Sam carving a giant turkey. And the iconography behind these folks is really interesting too. You know, NAST is doing the kind of thudding, very, very aggressive kind of messaging here. But around these people, there's a portrait of Lincoln, you know, the martyr of the Republican Party and of the Union. Next to him is a portrait of Washington. Next to Washington is a portrait of Grant with a banner that says 15th Amendment over it. And then behind Uncle Sam is a portrait of the New York Harbor with ships and a giant round building. And the title there says Castle Garden. So today we think of Ellis Island as being the immigration embarkation point. That's a later thing in New York Harbor. The building that welcome that people were processed through as they were entering the United States in New York Harbor in this period was Castle Garden. So this is and above the Castle Garden, it says welcome, right? So here we have the heroes of the Republic of American democracy, of stability and prosperity and self-government, Lincoln, Washington, and now Grant. And then the symbol of welcoming those people in. This is not the Statue of Liberty yet. That's not there. Which incidentally is first donated as a anti-slavery or celebration of the end of slavery monument. Comes to be associated with pro-immigration. But we have this Castle Garden in the background. And at the very bottom of the picture, there are two slogans next to the title of Uncle Sam's Thanksgiving Dinner. One says free and equal, and the other says come one, come all. So this is a really powerful image that is showing what it is to be America. And it's a, I show it in my classes every year around Thanksgiving, sometimes, sometimes not, but as an, as a, as a representation of what the ideal, what the ideology, what the utopia imagined by radical Republicans, and actually just rank and file Republican Party members, in 1869 of, we fought this giant war to make men free, to make men and women free. And now we're enjoying this, the fruits of that, which is these mixing of these cultures, self-government, self-democracy, democracy and universal suffrage, and prosperity. Prosperity centered around a domestic scene where we can all sit together and eat as sisters and brothers, and fathers and children, and mothers and children. So for me, it's a very powerful image of what it could potentially mean. But it's also one that is arguing for this ideal and arguing for the 15th Amendment as a way to complete this. And I can say a little bit more about the inclusion of the Chinese in the front here. I think that the chronology and the timing of that is important. But I've kind of filibustered a bit here. So that's read of the image. How does it land with you?
I do want to talk about the well, especially the Chinese image when we sort of compare and contrast it to a West Coast image that you sort of sent me some information about that I wasn't familiar with. But before we get to that, the image hits with me because I come from that sort of like Thomas Paine was the only good founding father sort of thing, and the Reconstruction is a failure, it's a failed revolution. And so, I mean, it hits...
A murdered revolution, I would say.
But the people in the picture are rendered in very sort of respectful sort of I don't know, it gives one a good feeling. But I will say this, and I don't know whether historians get involved in this sort of like, I don't know if it's conjecture, I don't know if there's any sort of scholarship around this, but I was told that woke, this is just happening, there's a woke mind virus, and it's new, and it has to do with the internet, and I don't even know what it has to do with. But I'm looking at this cartoon from 1869 that was in like this big magazine, Harper's, and it's woke. It's so woke. And so how do we deal with something like this? Like, how do we understand that actually woke's very old. It's you know, it's 19th century shit.
Even 18th century, right? If we go back to Paine. Yeah, I mean, I think this is something that continually surprises students too, and I think it catches them coming and going on this, right? So sometimes in Nast's other cartoons, where he's pretty nasty about the Irish, he really doesn't like the Irish. And he really doesn't like Catholics. And so he draws some quite nasty xenophobic cartoons in that way. But both this image and in those are, you know, the kind of xenophobia and paranoia and pairing of authoritarian upper class approach to immigration and blaming any kind of financial or economic problems on immigrants, the laundry list of the same kinds of things that get people accused of now, whether they be folks immigrating from the Middle East or from Mexico or from Africa, that's the same laundry list of stuff that we saw in the 1830s and 1840s. So it's exhausting in some ways, right? That it's literally the same talking points of they're here to secretly support democracy and take our jobs and, you know, sexually assault our women and ruin our blood purity and all kinds of nonsense, all the kind of white supremacist nonsense. That has not changed in 200 years. But on the other side of things, the hope for what America can be as an idea and not just as a place where it's the blood quantum of your whiteness, that is such an old idea. And I do take some kind of comfort in that it's been something people have fought for and lost, but fought for a very long time. This is not the first time this fight has been waged. And we are not the, if you support this idea, which I do, that America is an idea of self-government and democracy, and where people across all kinds of cultures can come and meet together, that is not a new thing. So I think that's encouraging in some way. And on the woke thing, right, it's been one of the things that's made being a 19th century historian feel like you're living in a waking nightmare or a fever dream for the last 15 years or so, is young men who supported the Lincoln campaign in 1860, in that presidential campaign, one of the things they did to support Lincoln is they would hold evening or nighttime parades, torch parades, where they would dress in military kind of uniforms and march through the streets. And they called themselves the Wide Awakes because they were awakening the nation to the dangers of the slave power. They got into, you know, some street battles and things like that. But generally they were there to oppose pro-slavery mobs. And so a lot of their symbols are giant unblinking eyes and things like that. And their opponents said that they were too awake, waking too many things up, that they had woken a dragon of slavery and now the nation would suffer. So the same kind of opprobrium of accusations of being too awake to the sufferings and the inequities in the United States, that is also something that is more than a century old.
Yeah, I think you asked sort of how it hits with me, the cartoon and the idea. It's sort of the same thing. It's like, actually, it's a little bit illuminating because people have been fighting about this very thing the same way for, you know, as long as we've been here and genocided the Indians. So, you know, it's sort of an eternal fight. And so it, for some reason, that makes it not as scary, I think. If that makes any sense?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it means that, you know, the battle is never fully lost, mm-hmm. right? There's always a new day. And then I should say too about this cartoon, there is prominently featured a Native American. He's kind of caricatured. He's got feathers in his hair, but it's interesting in particularly with NAST as a supporter of U.S. Grant, Grant's presidency took what it claimed was a more conciliatory approach to Native Americans. Not actually in practice. There was all kinds of violence and forcing people to give up land and forcing people into reservation schools. But it's interesting that Native Americans are included in this, that it's not just, you know, this is the problem with the we're an immigrant nation kind of argument, is that we, you know, in many ways the United States as a polity is, but there are other people here too. You know, and NAST is very consciously including those people in this, which is kind of interesting that it doesn't quite match up to what his party or his heroes were advocating per se.
Yeah, it's more radical than the radical Republicans.
Yeah. And I will say just, oh yeah, go ahead, please.
No,
yeah.
I was just going to mention, since you mentioned it, you know, I'm always struck by the fact that all of these characters are not caricatures. And of course the Native American one specifically with, you know, the feathers and a sort of the headdress thing seems to be, you know, a little bit of like, oh, that's a little over the top. But in 1869, there were still dudes out there rocking that. That was still sort of a thing. As you said, we snuffed it out. But you know, it seemed very sincere. The whole thing strikes me as a very sincere sentiment.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's trying to be sincere. Does he get things right? No. But, you know, it's cringe, maybe, is the way to describe it in today's parlance, right? It's cringe.
Yeah, but his heart's
in the right place. His heart's in the right place, I think, in this image at least. But I was going to say just about the Chinese folks who have their backs facing to the viewer in the image. But it's a Chinese man, you know, speaking to a white woman next to him, and his Chinese wife is, you know, scolding their little son as he eats. And in 1869, the outgoing Johnson administration, who kept on some of the same figures from the Lincoln administration, including William Henry Seward, who was also targeted in the assassination attempt that ended Lincoln's life. He survived. He went on to negotiate under Andrew Johnson the first equal treaty between the United States and China. And that was a treaty that was had been signed and proclaimed in 1868. And in 1869, in the incoming Grant administration, had renewed relations with the Qing Empire, the Empire of China, on what they considered and applauded themselves for as a equal basis, meaning that Chinese people had just as many rights in the United States and to travel to the United States as Americans did in China. That's what the equal, as opposed to prior treaties that had given foreigners in China more rights than Chinese people in Western or other places in the world. So I think the inclusion of these folks here, and that treaty was hard fought. It was hard pushed. And the fact that it comes through even under Johnson, I think says something about the establishment that surrounds him in terms of, like, you know, what we'd say like the deep state here, I guess. And it's something that is immediately a target in 1869 and then eventually is wholly repudiated and repealed by 1882. With the Chinese Exclusion Act.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about, speaking of, I guess when we were talking about this maybe a week ago, talking about history rhyming, there is a cartoon published on the West Coast in a more regional magazine, it should be said. I, that's what I took from it is, you know, Harper's was more of a national magazine. This was a small sort of regional magazine. They ran a spoof of the Uncle Sam's Thanksgiving dinner in a way that I think we would all be familiar with today. I was not familiar with this. Can you explain sort of the historical context by which this was produced and why? I think there's a lot of, obviously you're sort of an expert in the 19th century sort of relationship between the United States and China. So I think you'll have a lot to say about this sort of, we'll call it a reactionary cartoon in San Francisco.
Yeah, very much a reactionary cartoon, and you're absolutely right. It appears in a periodical by the name of the San Francisco Wasp, Wasp and just W, capital W and lowercase ASP. So this is not, although some resonances with the San Francisco white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. But yeah, it's a cartoon that by a much less well known cartoonist, this guy G.F. Keller. He's kind of a workaday guy. And it's a long, instead of a table in the round, it's a long banquet table with only men sitting at it, with a crowd of people waiting to sit at the table. And Uncle Sam is at the front with an empty plate and a knife and a fork. And the people at the table are a series of racial and ethnic caricatures. There's a Native American half, without a shirt on, eating what looks like a deer leg. There's a Chinese man angrily chewing on a rat, and someone sitting next to him vomiting or getting ready to vomit because he's disgusted by it. There's a mountain trapper kind of looking guy, you know, Grizzly Adams kind of guy who's smoking and drinking whiskey. And then serving the table, and not at the table, notably, is a black man or a caricature of a black man dressed in, highfalutin server, a waiter's garb. And he's carrying around a seemingly fully alive turkey. It's not been plucked. It's not been cooked. And so it's a scene of, you know, as you say, a caricature of this, and there's some European ethnic characters. There's a German eating a pile of sauerkraut and some sausages, and he's fat and he doesn't have good shoes. And there's a guy next to him eating frogs, and he's wearing wooden clogs. So I guess he's either French or Belgian or something like that. So there's this kind of collection of, it's the repudiation of Nast's vision, right? That Uncle Sam's Thanksgiving dinner is just it's just this motley, disgusting crew who have no table manners. It's all men. They're all just being hogs by themselves. There's no mixing. There's no contribution. And you know, I don't want to read too much into it. I don't think it's as thoughtful as Nast's is. But in 1877, it's in a very different political and context. Republican Party is still in power in the presidency, but it has lost power in Congress. Rutherford B. Hayes is continuing what his predecessors had done in drawing down the U.S. military in its occupation of the South, that is to say, ending the federal government's active protection of black rights and black freedom, and particularly the black franchise in the South, which means that many areas of the South are the terror campaigns waged by white supremacists and groups like the Klan, working hand in glove with the Democratic Party, have, quote unquote, redeemed the southern states, that is to say, put them once again under white supremacist rule. And that has changed the makeup of things in Congress. The Republican Party has split. There's a bunch of, they call themselves liberal Republicans, who say that, you know, like the economic crisis of 1873 demands that the U.S. government, you know, pay down its debt, go back to a hard currency and a gold standard, and remove any of these kind of crazy expenditures on such a frivolous thing like multiracial democracy. And on the West Coast, the way that this kind of works out, and part of what cracks the Republican Party nationally, is that in California and in the territories that become states north of it, in Oregon and Washington, West Coasters, and in states nearby like Nevada, the immigration of Chinese folks to work in the mines and work on the railroads, by the 1870s, those have dried up in a lot of ways, and they've become the convenient scapegoat for white terrorism and the scapegoat for worsening economic conditions. And the West Coast cracks the Republican coalition and trends towards the Democrats, and Republicans trying to compete for power on the West Coast start actively embracing anti-Chinese xenophobia and actively pushing back and repudiating the radical Republican idea of a multiracial democracy. So, and that shifts the national conversation, and national Republicans start aping that as well. And that's what we see in the Hayes administration. So this piece here is very much a Californian's view of what multiracial democracy is, which is to say a massive failure, that the United States is going hungry. Uncle Sam, is his plate is empty, while all of these foreigners just eat American food. And you know, foreigners here includes Native Americans, and that they're just mongrels who don't have any place in the polity. Right.
Yeah,
is that a fair enough of a context?
I hesitate to make this point, but I made it with you when we were talking earlier, and the image of the Chinese man sort of like ravenously devouring this rat on the end of a fork just mm-hmm. made me think of the Haitians in Ohio, you know, barbecuing cats.
Right, or the attack, and it's part of a political campaign to say that these people are eating pets and eating vermin, right? Yeah,
yeah. These people are coming into the country. They're disgusting. Mm-hmm. We have to somehow you know, dehumanize. It just rang so so accurately to me about what's happening. I didn't know what to do with it, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of these things where it's like, you know, the white supremacy is and white racial hierarchy. There's permutations, there's changes. You know, race is a fluid category, yada yada yada. But there are some things that xenophobes come back to again and again and again. I think because they are electorally winning, emotionally satisfying themes, and this idea of the other people who look different than you must be out of control savages and must be doing things that you deeply find disgusting, and particularly eating the wrong things and eating raw things and eating, you know, domestic animals and the wrong domestic animals. And, you know, in the case of the recent election and the recent campaign, these attacks on people are, you know, without any basis of fact. That's also true of the white Californians' attacks on the Chinese in the 1870s. These are all kind of just fantasies, fervid fantasies by racists who need to make their prejudices justified. And they can't, they're unoriginal people. Not to say that, you know, it's too simple to say that, like, well, if you're racist, you're dumb, but there is a real deep unoriginality about it. And it doesn't originate in the 1870s, but it certainly continues from there. And it's the same one note, marching band, you know, marching tune, for hundreds of years now, which is, you know, makes me very tired.
Yeah. Well, happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
You don't come to a historian for good vibes necessarily.
No,
right?
Look, we're trying to
you're talking to the wrong historian.
Well, I'll be honest with you. I had already sweared off sort of electoral politics, and I don't really talk about national politics much at all because it just doesn't. It's this. I don't want to draw too many comparisons, but it's the same thing. We're doing the same. Mm-hmm. It's you know, we're going down the same paths. It's the forces of reaction are not creative. They don't come up with a lot of new ideas. It's all the same idea. I look at it and I'm like, man, I've seen this before. You know, so you speak to some people in our circles and they would use words like bewildered, confused. I'm like, no, this is very illuminating. I feel like all of my priors are being proven right now. Like, this is stuff I've seen many times in the past. I mean, you must feel that even more acutely than I do.
I had this conversation with my students the other day. One of the things they're doing in one of my classes is they're analyzing newspaper ads, and specifically there's a wonderful database called Freedom on the Move that is a database of fugitives from slavery, runaway ads, and it's a great resource for asking all kinds of questions about both the experience of slavery and the experience of freedom and the stories of people who tried to get away or got away. And, you know, they're ads written from the slaveholder's perspective, and that is a tough thing. And, these are first and second year students, and they have not encountered a lot of these kinds of materials. Certainly not in the, you know, I've been doing this 20 years and they still, you know, horrify me and disgust me in many ways. But I noticed in their conversations about it, in some of their writing about it, that a lot of them use the word incomprehensible. And I had this talk with them where I said, you know, you've been in this class all semester. We've studied the kind of politics and the ideological and the intellectual. We've looked at a lot of sources. We've read Southern enslavers. We've read abolitionists. We've read white folks. We've read black folks. We've read men, women. You know, we talk about a lot of different stuff, right, to try and get a wide perspective on things. We read a lot of political literature. We read a lot of social and cultural stuff. And I said, you know, you can say a lot of things about these things, but if at this stage you are finding these incomprehensible, then I have failed, because you do have a context for these things. You do understand the economics of the Cotton South. You do understand the economics of slavery. You do understand the politics that led to the Civil War and things like that. So that was my kind of maybe too harshly given to them, because they're doing good work, but trying to say, you know, it's easy to try and back off and say we don't understand. It is harder to say we do understand, because then you're left with the question of what do we do?
Yeah. I
don't have a great answer for that, you know?
No. Well, that's the great, when you're a history buff, you don't have to have a good answer. You just be like, hey, this happened before. I don't know. You know, I'm just trying to tell you.
Sander your way through it.
Yeah. I think it's funny that word incomprehensible. I think you kind of had to reply in that way, and not because I think people can't, because they don't examine this stuff, they can't make heads or tails of it. It like you said, it actually is very comprehensible. People just don't know how to describe their feelings about it. How it was rooted in an economic system that just treated people like property, like chattel, right? Mm-hmm. It's perfectly comprehensible, but you have to, you have to kind of get down into the idea that yes, it looks cringe to you, or it looks like crazy to you, but if you sort of examine the context in which it was happening, people thought it was fine. And I think there's a lesson there.
Or some people thought it was fine too, right? I mean, that's
enough people did.
Right.
You know, right. It's weird. I think about that too. You know, yes, there have been people fighting, and obviously, you know, John Brown. I talk about Cloud Splitter all the time. I talk about John Brown all the time. But yes, mm-hmm. of course, people really, were against it. But of course, John Brown was looked at as a fucking maniac. And so,
I mean, he was a maniac. Like, I mean, he's a violent terrorist. But
that
but you can also understand he.
So here's the thing,
especially in his, you know, yeah. Yeah.
Here's the thing. It goes back.
He explained himself, you know.
It goes back to two things. The thing we talked about at the beginning of this conversation, religion, which now the violent terrorism, you know, I don't know. I mean, was Sherman's March to the Sea violent terrorism?
I think Sherman would have told you it was violent.
Yeah. Right? Well, I guess that's what I mean. Like, it's like, I think this goes because Brown explained himself so explicitly. I think it's pretty clear that for whatever reason, whether it was like a weird sort of magical religious reason or whatever, he certainly felt that he was fighting a war that was going to be fought, and actually he was correct. It was fought. We just talked about it. And so I don't know, man. It makes me, you won't be seeing me call John Brown or Nelson Mandela or Sinwar terrorists. I just won't do it because I've just, you know, the history has proven those actions were vindicated, I think. Do you know what I mean?
I mean, I think what that is, you know, terrorism is a tactic, I think, in you know, but you're right. I mean, it is more than just a description of a tactic. It's not a neutral kind of category. And I think a lot about, you know, over a decade ago, the writer and wonderful reader and writer of history, Ta-Nehisi Coates, had a really interesting piece where he considered and he thought through in a deep way, was the Civil War a tragedy? You know, and it's a question that I bring to classes again, but I think that really, you know, that was the first time I was in my graduate work, then I encountered this idea, but there's this thinking about, well, if there's mass death and what were individual lives lost and tragic, but was the overall struggle for freedom a tragedy? And he's got folks haven't read that essay, I recommend it. It's a, you know, the Google machine will deliver it to you, but it's a really thoughtful consideration from someone who is deeply aware of his own family's past and deeply read in the history itself.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And I think it's on a similar line of what you're describing about what words we use to describe these people.
Yeah, and I think I would say, and I read the new Coates, I listened to it on the plane. It's very good. And I'm not familiar with this particular essay. I guess I would say that, the death of so many people is a tragedy. But was it necessary? Was it ultimately something that sort of something had to give? You know, we couldn't be here with two economies like that. And so, yeah, I guess the loss of so many people is tragic, but being tragic doesn't necessarily, it doesn't have a connotation of like, we shouldn't have done it. It just means it was sad.
Yeah.
It just means it was
sad.
And
I think this is,
yeah, it was
this
sad.
This is what I appreciate, you know, about the conversations you have here is that, you know, these are sometimes people use, oh, it's complicated or it's complex as a dodge. Right. And that's not what's happening here. But things are complex. Things are complicated. The way we feel about them can be complicated. Yeah. And you can hold two thoughts in your head at the same time, right?
Yeah.
Or more, and many more. And I think that is one of the things that something like our present moment has really erased in a lot of folks, is the ability to approach things and not just use it's complicated as a reason for doing nothing, or it's complicated as a reason for not thinking through the consequences. But sitting with that discomfort, I mean, as the phrase goes, I think is one of the things, you know, sitting with and trying to think your way into the situation of someone reacting to a John Brown, someone trying to struggle through as Thomas Nast did. He lived through that, right? And where did he shake out, and what were his values witnessing this stuff in the way that we all witness quite a lot of this, quite a lot of similar amount of suffering and tragedy in the world. I think that is the useful, you know, I don't want to fall back on just talking my book here, but this is what is history good for? And it's not good for predicting the future, but it is good for trying to think through complicated stuff, and then also try to think through how some stuff isn't, as you say, it's not complicated.
I think, and that's why the beginning of this part of it, you were talking about the word incomprehensible. The point is, it is comprehensible. It's it, mm-hmm. it could it mm-hmm. could be bad, it could be sad, it could be radical, it could be anything. But actually, if you pay just a little bit of attention and think about it, it's perfectly comprehensible.
Yeah.
And we have to approach it in that way. It doesn't mean it's good. It doesn't mean I'm happy about it. It just means
right. Understanding is not agreement. Understanding is the beginning of perhaps disagreement. You know.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. 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 Exactly right. Exactly right. Well, happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
Happy Thanksgiving. Can I plug something?
I'm so glad you said it. You must have read my mind. Are you going to plug the Zoom thing? The research?
Yes.
That you're, yep, that's exactly what I wanted to plug. And I want to say this now. I hope Carl keeps this in. I was having a couple pints tonight, as I do on a Friday night, and played a little pool down at the pub. And my friend James Johnson said he loves hearing from Professor Dale Norwood, first of all.
Oh, that's very kind.
And I mentioned that some of your students will be presenting on sort of these fake manumissions that we've talked about before, and what they mean, and I'm excited about it. He wants now to come, and I want you to plug it as well, and so we'll link to it too.
Sure. Yeah. So along with my colleague Laura Helton, we have been running a research seminar that includes students from all over the University of Delaware, all kinds of different grad programs, undergrad programs, who have been doing research into the history of Newark and the history of Delaware College, the predecessor institution to UD, in the early 19th century. Part of a larger effort to try and understand slavery and freedom in Delaware. So the event is called Freedom and Slavery at Delaware College, a student research symposium. It's happening on Monday, December 9th, 2024 at 3 p.m. on Zoom. If you register for the event, you will get it'll be recorded, and we'll send you the link afterwards to the recording. But if you're able to come, we'll hear from some really wonderful students who've done some really great research building on early research by excellent folks like Syl Wolford and Denise Heyman and Crystal Sims and other wonderful people. Sophie Phillips, Representative Sophie Phillips, who did some research on this before she ascended to other things. But they're going to present some really interesting research on the kind of society and culture and governing institutions that intersected with Delaware College. And that includes things like how chattel bondage and other forms of unfreedom worked in Delaware. There's a lot of slavery in Northern Delaware that people don't know about, but also intellectual movements like the colonization movement, which was an effort to expel free Black people from Delaware. Things like where is the Episcopal Church and the Presbyterian Church in among these debates. So it's going to be a really rich program and an opportunity for people to ask questions of some really great student researchers who worked very hard over this semester to become experts in some very difficult materials. So I invited everybody to come, and if you're not able to come, to register so you can see the video. And we're super excited to hear what people think of what these folks have done.
It will probably not surprise you to know I'm already registered.
I would expect nothing less.
You probably know I'm already coming.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
When people send you stuff and they're like, "This might be of interest." I'm like, "Of interest? This is right. This is right in my wheelhouse, bro." Yeah.
Yeah. If it had 19th century baseball, we would even hit it square. But we didn't find any baseball.
Look,
stuff yet, but
look.
Someday.
Yeah. I mean, we can someday. Fit all that 19th century stuff into it. You know? we missed a big opportunity. I'm always thinking about that big missed opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I appreciate it. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So, Dale, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. And people really appreciate the little Thanksgiving lesson. And folks, we'll be doing this again soon. We do have a...
My pleasure to be here. My pleasure to be here.
Yeah, we do have a big series coming up. About some of these homeless sweeps. We're already starting to do some interviews. I don't know if that's going to be a full episode or pieces of an episode. We haven't decided what we're going to do yet. But you can look forward to that, since we mentioned it a little earlier. Other than that, just continue to focus on the idea that the left orientation is the best orientation.